I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Until a couple of days ago, few people in this country knew much about Kyrgyzstan, other than it's one of those former Soviet republics with largely unpronounceable names. For the record, Kyrgyzstan is in Central Asia. Its neighbors include Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and Afghanistan. It shares a long border with China and has both U.S. and Russian troops and military bases on its soil. What's especially interesting about Kyrgyzstan, now that its government has been toppled seemingly effortlessly and overnight, is the test model it offers for democracy in the area. If the Islamic world can have a democracy, which some doubt, it is likely to be seen here first. So what's your best bet as Kyrgyzstan struggles for a new identity? Do you think it can pull off a grand experiment in democracy building? And is democracy elsewhere always in America's best interest? We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And in just a moment, we'll be joined by several scholars and others who know Kyrgyzstan and the rest of the region very well. But first, we go to NPR correspondent Ivan Watson, who spent the day in the capital, Bishkek. We spoke just a few moments ago.
Well, the sun is set here in Bishkek, and after what was actually a pretty calm day, the city was surprisingly mellow, with people walking around in the sunny streets here and trying to go ahead with life as usual. Now there's a real tension in the air. A lot of Kyrgyz that I've spoken with are worried that there could be more looting tonight, a repeat of last night's looting, where a number of businesses, of shops and restaurants were attacked by looters. The window broken and people went in and took as much as possible. I saw owners of businesses putting up signs saying in Kyrgyz or in Russian, "We are with the people." And even the hotel I'm staying at now, people are putting on red armbands to try to signify some kind of cooperation with the opposition that has led these demonstrations that drove President Askar Akayev out of the country yesterday. So there are fears that there could be more lawlessness.
Ivan, tell us a little more about what happened yesterday, a rally that turned into a takeover. It seemed to occur with startling speed, that suddenly the government was no longer in place.
This happened so quickly. You'd had several days of demonstrations and protests down in the south of the country where entire towns were taken over by opposition demonstrators. And then on the first day of a real demonstration of just several thousand people here in central Bishkek yesterday, there was a clash with police and with supporters of the regime of President Askar. And then within a matter of hours, the demonstrators, they climbed the fence of the White House, the government building here, and stormed that building and then proceeded to take over other government buildings around the capital. And within a matter of hours, it was evident that there was in place, that the opposition demonstrators had taken charge. And up to this point, it's not really clear where President Askar Akayev is at this time. The Kyrgyz parliament that was supposed to be replaced by elections last week, it says that it has taken control. It is trying to create law and order on the streets here, even though there are very, very few police in uniform right now. And it has declared a former prime minister by the name of Kurmanbek Bakiyev to be the prime minister and acting president.
We know that both the United States and Russia have military bases there. Has there been any sign of intervention from either the U.S. or Russia?
There have been no signs of intervention on the part of the Russian or the American militaries, with the exception that there is a rumor going around that President Askar Akayev may have, in fact, fled to the Russian base here and caught a flight out from there. But that cannot be confirmed at this time.
It also seems startling, Ivan, that very few deaths and very few injuries in this takeover.
That's true. You did not have a bloodbath. As one Western informed observer that I spoke with said, it could have been much, much worse. You did have clashes. You did have some violence. There were some deaths reported yesterday, but you did not have a massive bloodbath. You did not have the security forces opening fire on the demonstrators when they clashed. You did, however, have a collapse of law and order where the security forces basically disappeared within a matter of hours, and you had rampaging mobs going through the streets attacking businesses. And there are fears right now that, there is not any real security force, any functioning police force. You have some volunteers now, and you have members of the former parliament who are trying they're making appeals to the people not to go out into the streets and not to loot what remains of the private sector here.
And do you get a sense at this point that people are nervous about what's going to happen next, or perhaps excited, perhaps even hopeful?
Well, I think there's some excitement. One lawmaker that I spoke with, an opposition lawmaker, asked me, how do you like our revolution? And I think there is some happiness. President Askar Akayev was very unpopular here. But there are nerves right now as well. And I was just in a central square where perhaps 1,000 people had gathered, and there were people stepping up to a microphone with loudspeakers and exhorting the crowd, telling young people to go home, to maintain stability, to not participate in the looting that people saw yesterday. And an interesting moment this morning, just coming through the center of town, I saw municipal workers in orange vests cleaning up, trying to clean the streets, but looting going on just behind them in a supermarket just over their shoulders at the same time. So you really have an effort to try to bring things back to normal, but you also have some people who are taking advantage of the collapse in law and order and of basically the loss of a government.
Ivan, thank you so much.
You're welcome, Gail.
NPR's Ivan Watson. And joining me in the studio now is John Schoeberlein, director of Harvard's program on Central Asia and the Caucasus. Thank you so much for being with us, John.
I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Give us a picture of what this place is. Where is it? How do you describe it? Who lives there?
Kyrgyzstan is a rather small country, about 4.5 million population, nestled in the mountain region just on the border with China. To the south of the very large Central Asian country of Kazakhstan, which is rich in oil wealth, Kyrgyzstan, by contrast, is not rich in anything particularly. It's also bordered on the south by two other former Soviet republics, Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, where there's been much more authoritarian rule, more poverty and a stronger influence of Islam in the society. The Kyrgyz are by background nomads. They're by appearance they look like Mongols, and they're also Islamic by tradition as well. Although many people have noted that Islam is relatively weak among some of the Kyrgyz, this is related to the fact that they've been heavily influenced by Russian contact, especially during the Soviet period. And many Kyrgyz are very much Russified as a result.
Russified meaning they identify with Russia much more than Central Asia?
Well, they've adopted a lot of Russian culture, including Russian language. There are even many among the urban elite who had a weak command of Kyrgyz as of the end of the Soviet period. Now people are trying to learn Kyrgyz more. They have also adopted the outlook of the European Russians, less religious, less traditionally oriented.
So you've been there many times. Were you surprised by this series of events? I know it had been building for a period of weeks, but the suddenness does seem to have taken a number of people by surprise. Were you one of them?
Well, it was difficult to predict exactly how things would go, and I can't say that I was predicting that this would happen as it has, although the tensions that underlie what we've been seeing over the last days have been really palpable and evident over the last even 10 years, you might say. There's terrible poverty in the country. There's a great deal of resentment that's connected with the fact that the government is seen as highly corrupt, and whenever a new government minister is named, it's considered that he's just going to enrich himself as long as he can until he loses his position in the government. So there's really a lot of resentment. Kyrgyzstan has gone from a country where there was really very little evident stratification. I mean, the richest and the poorest people did not seem that different. But now it's one of the most stratified countries in the world, in fact, with a very small group of the population, mainly former communists and party officials, who have managed to benefit from the privatization that's gone on. And the majority of the population is living on pennies a day.
And why is this area, why is this country of importance to the United States?
Well, there are, you might say, are two ways that we can assess its importance. On the one hand, it's a country where there's a potential for instability, particularly in connection with its its proximity to Afghanistan, the rising militancy among some of the Muslim population in neighboring countries like Uzbekistan and even in the south of Kyrgyzstan. And so we're concerned about security and stability. But on the other hand, it's a country where there has been a dramatic experiment in democratization that's been going on ever since independence. It reached a limit, in a sense. Akayev, the president who was just deposed, was seen as very much supporting democracy, but only to a point. And he wanted to assure his own position after over the longer term. So we see, in a sense, thwarted democracy or limited democratization. And so if we really believe in democracy as our foreign policy, if we want to, especially in the Islamic world, to see the flourishing of democracy, then Kyrgyzstan is one of these countries where we really should be hoping that that will develop.
Well, much more to talk about, especially on that point. We're talking this hour with Harvard professor John Schoeberlein and others about the recent uprising in Kyrgyzstan and what it means for democracy there. And we also ask, what does this so-called tulip revolution mean to you? 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection. I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. And joining me now on the line from Bishkek is Edil Besilov. He's chair of the Coalition for Democracy and Civil Society in Kyrgyzstan. Edil, welcome.
Hello.
Also joining us on the phone from Washington is Martha Brill Alcott, senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Martha, welcome to you.
Hi, thank you. Welcome.
And John Schoeberlein of Harvard University is in the studio with me. We're talking about the uprising in Kyrgyzstan, what the shift in power might mean for stability and democracy in that part of the world, and also, what does it matter to the United States? Let us know what you think. The number to call to join our conversation is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And Adil, I want to begin with you, because part of what sparked this uprising was discontent about the elections. Tell us that story. What were people upset about?
Well, of course, within the last 15 years, we never had elections which were recognized by international community as free or fair. But the last parliamentary elections were particularly marked by irregularities, and basically the political class of Kyrgyzstan and the people of Kyrgyzstan realized that President Akayev was determined to stay on, and actually he was going to turn Kyrgyzstan into even more authoritarian country, modeled on some Middle Eastern dictatorship, where power would be transferred to his children. And so we saw that if we don't stop this regime now, then for the next 20 or 30 years, we were to live under dictatorship. And the people of Kyrgyzstan stood up for liberty, and surprisingly, we achieved, we had the revolution.
And the fact that the opposition was only able to win about 6 seats in the parliamentary elections, is that what tipped people to the fact that this didn't seem quite right?
Well, these parliamentary elections were not real elections about some national issues. During these elections, the people of Kyrgyzstan never discussed the sort of issues other nations' democracies discuss, like what sort of foreign policy is going to be, internal policy, initiatives put forward. These elections were about money. People basically, there were lots of vote buying, and there were lots of other which don't have any relationship to democratic elections.
For example, people casting more than one vote? Was that the sort of thing you saw?
Well, multiple voting was a problem, although less than in the previous elections, because thanks to the U.S. Government, we had invisible electioning introduced. But many candidates were denied registration, just like Rosa Otunbayeva, leader of movement Atajurt. She was denied registration with four more ex-ambassadors, just because she's, she was out of the country for within the last 5 years. And many others were removed. Courts were adopting some politically motivated decisions. And electoral commissions, all the government authorities, they were very partisan and employed lots of administrative resources. And, opposition never had access to the state television and other state media. All of this, it wasn't a level playing field.
Martha Brill-Alcott, I want to turn to you for a moment, because under President Akayev, Kyrgyzstan was thought to be an island of democracy in this area. He came into office as a world-class physicist. He was viewed as a reformer. What went wrong?
I think that what went wrong was that he learned that democracy was a very messy thing, that it had unpredictable outcomes, that he couldn't second-guess what was going to happen and control the results. And I think he really became influenced by the kind of corruption that occurs to leaders of transition states, that there was so much money sloshing through even a poor economy at the time of independence, and so many economic opportunities that could be skewed to the advantage of those close to you, that he became seduced, if you like, by power and by the prospect of wealth.
So, in other words, a very few very rich people and a very many very poor people equals revolution at some point.
I think that's true, but I think that it was a lot more textured in Kyrgyzstan over the last 15 years. Part of the reason that you had a civil society beginning to flourish, as John talked about, was, a presence of outside assistance for civil society building. Part of the reason you had the expectations grow of the population was that there was an improvement in the standard of living for many, many people. But there was this, as John talked about, this great disproportion from extreme wealth to extreme poverty. But there was also, movement forward economically in the country, which raised expectations and I think made people feel that they were suffering disproportionately the poor end from what was going on.
I want to hear from some of our listeners in just one second, but before we do that, Adil, I just want to come back to you for a moment on that point. How much do you see of this is fear and frustration over these economic conditions, and how much is spurred by a genuine desire for democracy, however you choose to define democracy?
Well, I would say that, 5 years ago, we were much poorer. It was the situation looked even more clear, bad 5 years ago and 10 years ago. I would say that in 2005, most Kyrgyzstanis are much better off than they were in 2000. I think poverty is part of the equation, but I think more of it was the genuine longing of the Kyrgyz people for democracy and for dignity. They just were fed up with the daily lives of the Akayev's regime.
Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Billy now. He's on the line from Boston. Hi, Billy.
Hi.
What did you want to add?
What I wanted to add is that the professor was talking about the importance of Kyrgyzstan to us, and my point was geopolitical. Prior military officer. I was at our base there about 2 years ago, and it's one of our few opportunities to have a large number of troops so close to the Chinese border, particularly flanking them on their west side, if you will. And not that we're into containment theory, but that we have troops in the east, of course, but now if the new government wasn't as friendly to us, and there's no reason to believe they wouldn't be, but and we had to move our troops, I think that would definitely affect us geopolitically.
So definitely, Billy, a reason that we should be paying attention.
I'm certain that the government is paying attention. I don't know how many average person is, but I'm sure that Central Command, those people that have troops there, and the Department of Defense are probably interested.
Billy, thank you so much for the call. John Chamberlain, let me put that to you. As he indicates, certainly a reason for the government to be keeping close watch on this. And do we have any sense of whether the next government might be friendly to the U.S.?
Well, Billy said that we're not into containment, but perhaps we really are. I think that the presence of U.S. troops in both Kyrgyzstan and neighboring Uzbekistan is related not just to the war effort in Afghanistan, but also to a broader goal of limiting Russia's and China's influence in this region. And so, in a sense, there is a continuation of the Cold War era policy that's operating in the minds of our defense thinkers. And I think that to some extent that's unfortunate. It may be that we aggravate problems more than solve them by having a military presence. As far as the question of whether the new government would be just as friendly towards the United States, I think that it's probable that they would. Many people have been trying to assess whether this revolution has a strategic impact both for Russia, for China, and for the United States. And my guess about this, although we haven't heard a great deal about foreign policies from the key figures yet, but my guess is that they're going to want to occupy the same position as the previous government has in relation to these major powers. They want to be friends with all three.
Well, and how do you see it in terms of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, which do have pretty authoritarian governments? They must be getting a little nervous seeing what's happened there, and also in Ukraine and also in Georgia.
Yes, after the revolutions in Ukraine and Georgia, if you want to call them revolutions, the authorities in all of the Central Asian countries, including Kyrgyzstan, were quite noticeably nervous about the potential for these kinds of things happening in the region. And so, for example, in Uzbekistan, there was a very noticeable crackdown on the even very limited activity of NGOs, foreign NGOs in the country, and so on. And so they really do not want to see this, as they would see a contagion of democracy or of the popular power. I expect that we will, both in Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, as well as Kazakhstan, will probably see further reactions that are aimed at containing that. I think at the same time, the prospect of additional popular movements like this emerging has greatly increased across the region. And just yesterday or today, in Uzbekistan, there were demonstrators in front of the Kyrgyz embassy saying, "We support the democratic developments there."
I want to go to Jillian now. She's on the line from Watertown, Massachusetts. Hi, Jillian.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
I spent a couple years in Osh in southern Kyrgyzstan teaching English, and I think it's hard to envision the difference between southern Kyrgyzstan and northern Kyrgyzstan, that these massive mountains divide Bishkek and Osh, and Jalalabad and Osh are nearby each other. That's where the troubles began, and I just got an email yesterday from an Australian friend who's working in Osh still, who says that there's a sense of resentment from the southern tribes or clans that the northern clans just seem to dominate politics, and it is significant that that's where the troubles began, in Osh and Jalalabad down in the south. But he was very amazed, surprised to report that as of yesterday, this is 1400 Greenwich time, yesterday, the traffic police are back on the road and everything's quiet in Osh. So I think that's really a good sign, because about 12 or 13 years ago, they had, an uprising, an ethnic uprising there that cost hundreds of lives. So I just wanted to report that things are peaceful again in Osh, and it's an encouraging note, at least, I thought, to add to the conversation, because everyone focuses on the capital, but the southern part is important, too.
Thank you, Jillian. We appreciate the call. And to that point, Martha, what is your sense of why the opposition surfaced first in the south? Was this for ethnic reasons, or primarily economic ones?
I think it surfaced in the south for two reasons. Several of the opposition leaders are themselves from the south, so they went back to the districts that they either were elected from or in some cases were denied election from. And I think there was also a perception among the opposition that the South would be an easier region to take control of first because of the things we've all been talking about. The dissatisfaction there was lower. Dissatisfaction there was much higher. The standard of living there was lower. People from the southern regions have felt disenfranchised politically throughout the independence period. For most of the last 50 years, the person in charge of either the Soviet Republic or the independent country has come from the north. So they viewed the electoral process this time as denying southerners their rightful place and not just denying some opposition figures their rightful place. So I think they accurately assessed the situation and felt that they could both establish control and establish order. I mean, your listener who talked about the fact that there really has been a transfer of power and a restabilization of power in Osh, I think is really a critical fact to why they felt able to go on to Bishkek and have demonstrations and turn their attention from the south to the north. They didn't leave the south in turmoil in order to try to go to the north. They first tried to both get power and then stabilize power and then try to move on.
Which, at least so far, they seem to be doing very well. Mm-hmm. Adil, back to you. What else can you tell us about these protesters? Because I was struck in looking at the photo gallery that the New York Times had online. A lot of young faces in that crowd.
Yes, many. And, you know, our coalition, we run election, nonpartisan election observation, and, you know, we always have many young people spend a day for us as volunteers, election domestic nonpartisan observers. And, you know, usually young people, students, you know, they are the best in as election observers because an older person usually gives in after some pressure. Or, you know, they sort of act as if, you know, because they were raised in a Soviet culture where they, you know, wouldn't dare to speak against authorities. But the young of our country are completely different. They speak up, they are idealistic, and they haven't learned the lessons that, you know, of double standards, etc. So the young, absolutely, yesterday there were many young people in the square, and it was basically the youth. You know, I literally saw leaders of the opposition urging the people to return to the square, not to attack the government building, urging them, like, you know, to stop. Let's have the rally. We are supposed to have a rally. But the youth of, the students, and many of them got beaten up earlier by the police and by the thugs hired by Akayev's family. You know, they just didn't listen to anybody and just, occupied the building. And that was the revolution.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection. And now to Stoneham, Massachusetts. Larry's joining us on the line. Hi, Larry.
Hi. I would like to raise the question with maybe some of your experts as to what influence the elections in Iraq, even though we don't know where they're going, but that they actually happened, may be encouraging the such revolutions as the one in Kyrgyzstan, and also the likelihood that another could be Soviet subsidiaries or in other places there would be more encouragement, like a chain reaction.
All right, so the question is about whether there is a likelihood of a domino effect here. Larry, we're going to ask you to hold the thought and everyone else to hold it as well. We need to take a little break here. There has been another revolution in a former Soviet republic. What does that mean for U.S. security in the region, to democracy? And also, what does it say to you? The number to call is 1-800-423-8255 to join our discussion. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harris, and you're listening to The Connection. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection, and this hour we're talking about the government takeover in Kyrgyzstan. The number to call to join our conversation is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And John Sherberline, I want to put Larry's question to you that we were considering just before we took a break about the possibility of a domino effect here. You know, for anyone who grew up or who was around during Vietnam, domino effect generally has some pretty sinister connotations. But in this case, could it be a positive thing, democracy breaking out all over?
Well, if you look around Central Asia, there are five Central Asian former Soviet republics, and the situation is very different in each one of them. You could say in Kazakhstan, it's the most similar in that there have been relatively open democratic development, open media, and so on. And there, I would expect that the events in Kyrgyzstan will have the effect of emboldening the opposition and perhaps spurring them to more a stronger position. The question, of course, will come most currently when there are actual elections. In the other countries, for example, in Turkmenistan, there is no opposition. It's the most authoritarian, you might say even almost totalitarian government in Central Asia. So I don't expect anything like that happening there unless it's more of a palace coup. In Uzbekistan, the political situation is perhaps the most volatile because this opposition has been very severely suppressed. There's no real opposition in the country, unlike Kyrgyzstan, where there's been a limited but fairly active opposition. In Uzbekistan, the opposition that existed at the end of the Soviet Union was basically made illegal, and most of them were thrown in jail or forced out of the country. So if there were an uprising there, and I wouldn't think it unlikely. That is, there is a lot of discontent in that country too. But we can expect that the government would take a much heavier hand in response. And so what would be crucial is whether there are disagreements within the governing elite and perhaps some people going over to the side of the opposition. That could be quite decisive. In the case of Kyrgyzstan, it's interesting to see how the events developed because nobody, not even the opposition, expected things to be where they are today. And the crucial aspect of the situation apparently is that Akayev decided that he was going to arm a mob that would try to fight off the demonstrators in Bishkek. They were too small, and they lost the battle. But at the same time, that emboldened, that energized the mob the opposition supporters in Bishkek, who then went on, even without the opposition leaders asking them to storm the presidential palace and to lead to the transfer of power. So a revolution took place almost unplanned and instigated by what might now be viewed as a very foolhardy decision on the part of the president.
I want to bring Peter into the conversation now. He's on the line from Thomasville, North Carolina. Hello, Peter, and welcome.
Hello, Gail. Thank you. I just was amazed at the surprise that everyone seems to be expressing over the fact that Kyrgyzstan has finally had its revolution. I was there in 88, 89. It was a very open society compared to what I found in Moscow and some of the other places. The caller from Osh has it right. It was very poor and very isolated from the main part of Kyrgyzstan. Kyrgyzstan is very rich, mineral rich, gold, silver, no oil, but the government never saw fit, I think, to exploit that to its full extent. There is a great divergence of wealth there. I am not a bit surprised that the young people who hunger not so much for democracy, big D, but rather the accoutrements, the wealth, the videos, I can remember seeing a Time magazine so dog-eared it was hardly readable because so many people hungered for the West and what it had to offer. And now, finally, something has tipped the balance. The communists who never left when I was there are now on the run, and it's going to be interesting to see what's going to replace them.
It will indeed, Peter. Thank you. And Martha, speaking of people who might be on the bench, about to become key players or perhaps key players already, can you sort of call the roll for us here? What names should we be looking for as this unfolds over the next weeks?
Well, I think there are three names that we should be looking at as things unfold. The first is the person who has become acting prime minister, Kurmanbek Bakiyev, who was prime minister until 2002. He's somebody who had declared his intention to run for president prior to these events. And he is somebody who comes from the South, and he will be a serious presidential contender. Another person we should look at is Roza Otunbayeva, the former foreign minister of Kyrgyzstan, who's been in diplomatic service her whole professional career. She is somebody who returned to the country in October and played a critical role in uniting the opposition. She will play a critical role in this transfer of power. She's now acting foreign minister, and she'll be the one that has to sell the revolution to foreign critics, deal with the neighbors. The third person we should be looking at is Felix Kulov, the former vice president and mayor of Bishkek and governor of the oblast around Bishkek as well. He was a political prisoner for the last 5 years, and he was released yesterday. He was the country's major political figure. He's always argued that the corruption charges against him were made up by the government. He has always been Akayev's principal opponent in the country, the political figure whose shine threatened to outshine Akayev even at his most popular times. He is certainly likely to run for president. So I think these three people are the names we're most likely to see in the news in the coming weeks. And I think one of these three, especially one of these two men, is most likely to be the next president of Kyrgyzstan.
So, Adia, let me put that question to you as to how likely you see the whether people will rally behind a single leader, or do you think it's going to be confusing for a while?
You know, it's better be confusing because we don't want to replace one authoritarian leader with just another. You know, I think we learned the lesson a very hard way. We will never allow one man to put himself above the nation, above the law, above the constitution. We will never repeat the sort of mistake with which we had with President Akayev. And so, obviously, this is the beginning of a very long and a difficult road. You know, the story in Kyrgyzstan is not over. It's just beginning. We need to create conditions for free and fair democratic elections, with free press, with freedom of meetings, with many, many, many other components of democratic elections. And hopefully within 3 months we will create the society which will be pluralistic, which will be tolerant to difference in opinion, and we will provide a level playing field for several candidates, and it will be up to the people of Kyrgyzstan to elect the next president.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you want to join us. From Chesapeake, Virginia now, Josh is on the line. Hi, Josh. Welcome.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I basically had a question about, I know we have a military presence in the area, but what is the general feeling towards Americans in Kyrgyzstan, and does anyone have any idea of whether we're going to get involved there and how that would that would take well with the population? Because, you know, we're extended already, and I just wondered what people there thought about it.
Thanks, Josh. John, let me put that question to you and also broaden it just a bit, because we haven't really talked that much about the role of Al-Qaeda and Islam. Are there internal tensions between people who identify themselves as Russians first, which we did mention earlier, but also those who identify themselves as Muslims first, and how those distinctions might manifest?
Kyrgyzstan society is, you could say, divided between those who are Europe-oriented and those who are more traditionally oriented. And, of course, the line between them is not clear. It's partly mapped out regionally in that in the south there's a much more traditional orientation, and the role of Islam is much more important. In the north, people have been much more Europeanized and tend to look more to Europe and to Russia. So there is a bit of a divide there. But in terms of how people respond to the United States, I would say that at the same time as there is a level of distrust for any outside power, and that applies to both Russia, the United States, and China, There is a general sense that the model for society that they would like to pursue is really much more in the American direction in general. And so there is a base of distrust, but at the same time, general goodwill. As far as U.S. involvement goes, I don't see any prospect for U.S. military involvement, but the State Department has been watching developments in Kyrgyzstan quite closely, and I think that they view the developments as generally positive. That is, of course, they don't want to see the outbreak of violence, but the prospect for opposition coming to power is not something that the United States sees as necessarily threatening or undesirable. And I, as I mentioned before, I think that there will be a strong relationship between the United States and Kyrgyzstan no matter what government emerges from this. As far as the role of Islam goes, there has been a growing orientation towards Islam among a part of the population. And this includes especially the rural population and in the south of the country, but not only, in many parts of the country. People who think that the Soviet period really took their culture away from them and that they need to return to what is basic about their own culture, to go back to Islam. And that opens the possibility for more influence from Islamic groups. I don't see any direct influence from terrorist organizations like Al-Qaeda, but there are underground Islamic organizations which are gaining influence in Kyrgyzstan as in the neighboring countries. And one of the things that Kyrgyzstan will have to come to terms with over the coming years is this divide between the Islamic orientation, the people who don't really see Europe as a model, and the more Europeanized urban elite.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255 if you'd like to join us. I'm Gail Harris. You're listening to The Connection. Adil, I want to ask you about that as well. What's the word on the street? What are you hearing people talk about? There have been some mutterings on the internet that some in Russia think that the U.S. is behind this. U.S. officials say no. What are you hearing on the street as to what people think is behind it and whether, you know, that's a sinister thing or a good thing if the U.S. is involved in any way?
Well, you know, it's of course our president, President Akayev, or former President Akayev. I cannot get used to this. You know, former President Akayev. You know, after events in Georgia, he wrote a book. He dedicated a book to the Rose Revolution in Georgia, and he described how it was the Western involvement and how it was a whole conspiracy. And after Ukraine, after the Orange Revolution, he was just, you know, he made speeches about it. And so there was, you know, actually this paranoid attitude of President Akayev actually helped a lot of people to realize, you know, how, you know, actually it didn't help him. You know, it was one of those things which John and Martha mentioned. It was President Akayev himself. He burned, I mean, you know, it's his paranoia, which basically, it's all his fault. He needs to blame himself. So the people of Kyrgyzstan suddenly realized that, you know, the people can stand up and can just do it. And but obviously, we will be hearing a lot, you know, in Russian press and perhaps in international press that it was the United States. But I think, you know, the credit all belongs to the people of Kyrgyzstan.
Adil, you'll be interested in a BBC News report that says Akayev is accusing the opposition of staging an anti-constitutional coup and that he is denying that he had resigned and said his absence was temporary. Do you think there's any chance he's going to show up again?
Well, you know, I am very much disappointed with the way he chose to make the statement. You know, we received some, you know, email message from where, you know, on some sort of Hotmail account, Mail.ru, it's a free service and website, it's sort of anonymous. I think President Akayev, former President Akayev, should have more dignity and convene a press conference and have some sort of more dignity announcing this. But it was some sort of, like, you know, runaway criminal who is making anonymous letter. I think he has more chances of becoming president of Brazil than president of Kyrgyzstan.
And who knows what the Brazilians would make of that. Martha Brill Olcott, to you on that point as well, do you think that we're going to be hearing much from President Akayev again, or is he going to fade from the scene?
I think he should fade from the scene if he's concerned about the stability and well-being of his population. as Adil just said, you know, a lot of his behavior has been unpredictable, a lot of the messier he made himself at the end by his decisions. And so it's always dangerous to predict whether someone will behave in his own best interest and his nation's best interest. But let's hope that President Akayev realizes, or former President Akayev realizes, that power has already shifted.
And Martha, what do you think in terms of the difference that this makes to the United States?
I think that in the short run, this really doesn't make any big difference to the United States. I think our air base will remain. I think the political orientation of Kyrgyzstan is going to remain. I think the real concern for the United States is that this new government succeed in holding democratic elections and in liberalizing Kyrgyz society, and that there not be instability in Kyrgyzstan. Of course, this ups the stakes that there will be instability in neighboring countries, but as long as it works in Kyrgyzstan, then the U.S. can step-by-step deal with any instability or try to respond to any instability that occurs in neighboring states. But I think that if this becomes an example of democracy can't work in Central Asia, then there will be real impact on U.S. policymakers, and they will have to rethink how we should respond in the region.
And John, I want to give you the last word here. We just have about a minute or so, but you see this as a really important test case for democracy.
I do indeed. I think that, as Martha was saying, if the process goes well in Kyrgyzstan, it will prove all the critics wrong that say that democracy is not possible in these former authoritarian countries where there's no history of democracy, in Islamic countries where it's seen that Islam might be somehow hindering the development of democracy. And so we really need to see a positive outcome here. It's very important. It will be a good demonstration for neighboring countries. It'll take the rug out of under the feet of those who claim that they need to be strong authoritarian leaders because the population can't produce an outcome satisfactory to everyone.
Well, we'll be watching as you will. I want to thank all my guests. John Scherbelein is director of the program on Central Asia and the Caucasus at Harvard University. Thanks, John.
Thank you very much.
Also, Martha Brill Olcott, senior associate with the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you.
And Adil Basayalov, chair of the Coalition for Democracy and Civil Society. He joined us from Kyrgyzstan. Thanks, Adil.
Thank you for having me.
And earlier, we heard from NPR correspondent Ivan Watson in Bishkek. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection.